outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Well, good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Wayne.
Did you have a good 4th of July weekend?
I did have a good 4th of July weekend. Jess and I, we kept having plans fall through for the 4th of July. So we had friends that we were going to meet with, and then they were going to do something. And long story short, we rolled over, like I rolled over July 3rd and was like, Jess, would you want to do something crazy? And she kind of looked at me and was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, well, do you want a road trip down to Nebraska and surprise my family and be a part of their big celebration? And so that's what we did. We got up and we had about an hour and a half of prep time, and then we rolled down to my family's, and the girls got to play with their cousins and had a great barbecue and lots of games. And it was a wonderful 250th anniversary of our nation's history.
Cool.
What about you?
Glad to have it. We had we celebrated on July 3rd with my family. So we had time at my daughter's house, and some other folks were there and playing some games and having fun together. On Saturday, we had some friends that we've known for 51 years who drove down from the Central Valley to hang out for the weekend with us. Sarah and I had tickets to go to the Hollywood Bowl and watch the Beach Boys in concert. Had some fireworks and the orchestra. It was impressive.
So and, was there actually a Beach Boy that was singing?
They had one Beach Boy on the stage, the only living one. He's 85 years old. He tried to sing and it was not pretty. He could barely walk on the stage. I mean, he is not just 85. He's difficultly managing my life, 85, but
hard lived 85.
You could tell how much this meant to him, though. I mean, they did tributes to those who had passed away. They were showing videos of the Beach Boys in their heyday. It was reliving growing up in the 60s in California. There was a lot to it that was just fabulous. The orchestra was amazing, and the fireworks were just outstanding. They were, and we were right in, right in the bowl, and they're right above the stage, and you were right on top of them. And it was so impressive. It was a great way to celebrate the 250th birthday of this nation.
That's the one thing that I do miss about being out in Southern California. One of the few things around the holidays anyway, that I miss about Southern California is, man, they do celebrations well, whether it be fireworks or New Year's experiences. I mean, they do some really cool celebration experiences.
Yeah, it's the first time we've ever done that on the 4th. So we enjoyed it, and probably wouldn't go back just because of all the traffic involved in getting in and out of that place. And we get home at midnight, which for Sarah and I is 2 hours well past our bedtime. And I don't sleep in well, because when the light starts and the sun comes up, I tend to wake up. We had a great time with our friends. I stayed a couple of days and we just reminisced and talked about where Jesus' journey is unfolding. And
are you ready for Kansas City? That's coming up.
Oh my gosh. I just got noticed from United Airlines. I've been bumped up to first class by my, I guess my gold star status with them.
Nice.
It doesn't do any good these days. They fill up first class without any bumping anybody up usually, but this one's a bit empty. So it's a little plane straight from LA to Kansas City. So I'll have a little extra room, which will be nice on that flight. So yeah, looking forward to it. Can't wait to get there, getting some email from people that are excited. So I talked to Toby last week, and he's there. He's ready to go. So it's looking good. Excited.
What have you been holding on your heart for that trip? And just what are you hoping God does in the midst of the conversation while you're in Kansas City with Toby?
I don't have a specific hope about anything. I've shed those a long time ago. I like going in just saying, God, what are you going to do? And where are the conversations going to wander? Obviously, I hope it's meaningful for people. I hope it not only just explores the themes of the book, that will definitely do that, but the idea is to help people process it inside their own journey. So if they're embracing that stuff, then how do we find, if you don't already know, that love relationship that makes you just from the inside, then maybe help people find that place, find a new step in their own journey and relationship.
Bummed that we aren't going to be able to be there. And I can't wait to hear the conversations that are going to come out of Kansas City this next weekend.
Yeah, I tried to invite you, dude. You just booked up your summer too much.
definitely did that. That's for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to carry on without you, but I look forward to it. I think the fellowship among the people that are coming, much like the Israel trips I do, the fellowship around it will be as important as the things we explore together. And hoping we'll find our way into a good conversation, and it won't just be questioning and answering the experts, because Toby and I are not experts on these things. We're brothers on a journey, and if we can help other brothers and sisters enjoy their journey, then we'll do it.
Love that.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. Still trucking on through the summer here. We should take a break. We never do.
We took a short one. We took one for 4th of July.
Took a one. That's not a break. That's a hiccup. But yeah, we did. Got a best thing you heard this week?
I do. So I had a wild kind of random God Journey experience. I woke up, and normally I don't have notifications on my phone from any of my social media feeds. So if I get an email or a message from somebody on social media, it might be that day that I see it. It might be 3 weeks down the road that I see it. I happen to have my notifications on because I was selling something on Facebook Marketplace. And so I wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything. And I got an email from David. He's a longtime podcast listener for The God Journey. And he, because of the industry that he's in, he happened to be coming through Sheridan on his way to Idaho. He had messaged me on Facebook and said, "Hey, I am going to be staying in Sheridan. Would you like to go out for dinner?" And I happened to be able to see the message on the day that I received it. He was going to be rolling out early in the morning the next day. And so we were able to go and get food together. And we were sitting down to start dinner, and it launched into just a wonderful conversation. But one of the things that he said was, "I bet Papa has a knee-slapping grin on his face because of this conversation right now." And it, like that, it just embodied the conversation that we had, and just the personality that I think of when I think of Jesus, when like that, just that sense of humor of, here's a surprise, here's an opportunity for community and relationship and to really dive into the heart of Christ with a fellow believer that I don't know super well. And I just felt like that knee-slapping grin as a result of the conversation fit God's heart perfectly for that, for just the whole thing being encompassed. So, love
it. How fun is that? That's right.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Maybe God had a little of that with our weekend with our old friends, too. Who knows? We had a 50-year-old friendship, and you have something that's fairly new that you're hanging out. That's just kind of
first time meeting them in person.
Okay. That's going to be true of me and Toby next week. First time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys authored a book together, and this is the first time you're meeting.
My life doesn't make sense in a lot of ways. Rarely does. One thing I read this week I thought was great. Somebody commenting on a magazine article in Relevant Magazine. And I'll probably come back and explore some of this later, if not in this podcast, in a future one, because it really is good. But said this, "The enemy's greatest victory wasn't atheism. It was convincing the church that the most spiritual posture is one of fear. Fear of sin, fear of the devil, fear of an angry God, and that constant awareness of darkness is the same thing as walking in the light."
Wow.
Isn't that a punch?
That was on a comment on an article?
It was somebody posted a reference to the article, and then they were writing a little bit of a column about it. But in that column, I don't have the name of the person in front of me. I'm sorry. Man, I grew up in that. I grew up when there was a lot more fear of God. We talked about the love of God, and our worship had love to Jesus kinds of things in it. But the overall prevailing thing, I just think about, was fear. It was, and it was fear of everything. Fear of the devil, fear of God, fear of sin, fear of making a mistake, fear of diverting from God's will, not being in the perfect will of God. And then therefore, it was. And how all of that fear sets up more trauma than relationships. So when we're talking about, like the last couple podcasts, we're talking about thirsting. We're talking about finding our way into embracing God's presence inside of us and recognizing it. And I think it's really critical. This article in Relevant Magazine was about that exactly. It's somebody was doing some brain science scans on people who were praying, not just Christians. It also involved monks and other kinds of faiths, but they were trying to see where the mind is at when people are praying.
Ooh, okay.
And one of the sidelights of this, which was fascinating, was it wasn't so much that people were praying. It was who they were praying to, which not the Christian God versus the non-Christian God. That wasn't right. It. It was the image of God a person brings into their prayers.
Oh.
So if you had a fear-based view of God,
okay,
you can keep the brain's threat and survival system on alert, encouraging anxiety, rigidity, defensiveness. And by contrast, a love and compassion-centered view of God tends to foster openness, connection, emotional resilience, and empathy. This is all from neuroscientist Andrew Newberg, who did the research on this, spent 20 years scanning the brains of people. Okay. And he says, how we view God will influence not merely what we think about reality, but how we experience it.
What we think, but how we experience it.
Yeah. Isn't that something? Oof.
Man, that's so interesting. So how did he set up the groundwork ahead of time to figure out what people's perspective or connection with God is? Like, how did he lay that groundwork?
I have no idea. The article I read didn't refer to that.
Okay.
It just said he did brain scans and he wanted to know what was going on in the brain while people were praying.
Yeah. Because that would be really intriguing for me to figure out, okay, how did he prep that and to figure out what is the perspective, what is the persona that we're attributing to God and how that influences the way that we pray? Because I'm very much with you in that. When I first was growing up, it was more of your very traditional Baptist perspective background. And it was a lot about fear. It was, how do we keep you in line in regards to behavior, fearing the wrath of God, fearing the holiness of God? That was an interesting one for me. God is so perfect. God is so holy that any mistake, any error, any quote unquote sin that was a part of my life, man, that caused this major gap of separation between me and God. And I needed to come with this kind of groveling level of repentance, I want to come to somebody that I trust and know and in the healing process, but a groveling of somebody that sees me at all times and yet could smite me at any minute. It just, man, that was the space that I dwelled when I was first getting to know God. And I think that's also why I lean so hard into a lot of the performance stuff. Is because it's like, okay, if this God really can see me all the time, and if he is that fear worthy, let's just say, then man, I better make sure that my P's and Q's are taken care of, because this, I don't want to cross this divine thing in the sky that could take me out at any moment.
Yeah, we gave lip service to the idea that God can't bear to look on sin, and yet we always thought he saw every sin we ever committed.
Yes.
It was kind of a religious double talk. Wait, he can't bear to look on it, which means, boy, if I screw up during the day. And it isn't just about prayer. This is about how you're going about your day. And if you do something wrong, the feeling of shame and guilt and trying to ask forgiveness, and part of asking forgiveness in my day was always promising not to again.
Oh, absolutely.
And then when you did it again, it was like, okay, now it's doubly worse. And then it gets to be ridiculous. How am I going to promise God I'm not going to do this again when I've already done that 19 times and I've done it again? And he knows I'm going to mess this up. And I just seeing the world now much more through trauma, through Sarah's experience with it. When you live under threat of punishment or threat of making a mistake or fear and what it does to the mind and the body, how it distorts it, and thinking, man, we were actually teaching people to live in that fear in the hopes that it would make them better people, and it didn't.
Well, it changed behavior, though. It brought people into alignment.
The outside.
Absolutely, on the outside. I mean, one of the biggest ones that I can think of growing up, back to kind of the conversation that we had with Joni about patriarchy, was the whole purity culture thing. Yeah. And so there was the big purity rivals, and you get the ring and you have all this. And just the conversations that I would have with peers and with people that were older or younger than me, and the conversations around, Did you kiss someone? Did you, I mean, any kind of hint of anything that might not be in perfect alignment with God's desires in regards of physical intimacy with another person? And then, you know, how do you regain your spiritual virginity? Because, man, God doesn't. I mean, God is so angry at that. And I mean, wearing the ring as a reminder of don't mess up. You better not mess up. I mean, it had nothing to do with this loving commitment. I mean, there was kind of this lip service of, well, God loves you. And, you know, he doesn't want you to live or experience the punishment and the consequences of you making those mistakes. And so we're going to have these huge conferences where you get up and have this emotional experience and you wear a physical representation of your vow not to mess up. And but there was nothing love-based, relational. There was no, like, it was very much conformity and fear-based.
Yeah, we talked that some this weekend with the couple that was here about how our upbringing in these things spiritual what gave us this forgiveness and amnesty from God and get out of hell free card and get to go to heaven. Yeah. But it still left us having to perform better to keep God happy in some way.
Yes.
Even though it supposedly wasn't linked to heaven or hell, it was linked to getting God's blessing or disfavor. I grew up where you could lose your salvation in the way that we thought of all that back then. Yeah. So there was that added pressure. But how that made learning the very thing we've been talking about thirsting, engaging presence and knowing God, all of that moves in the opposite direction of what it takes to foster the environment in which relationship can take place with God. Because you can't start from fear. You just can't.
And I agree with you. I completely agree with you. But how have you seen God start to unravel that or untangle that, whether it be in your life or in the lives of others, so that they're able to have the heart posture to be able to thirst for God in a healthy way? My dad and I got into a really intriguing conversation this weekend that was super powerful. I got into some of that core heart identity, like the irresponsible son stuff. It was awesome. It was a lovely dialogue. But one of the things that we were really exploring is, okay, how does God untangle those things that are so deep, that influence how we perceive who he is, that influences even at the neurological and psychological, physiological level of this God is a threat to me in some form or fashion. Like I need to keep that fight, flight, freeze, or fawn online, close at hand, ready to go, because I never know how this God might respond. How do you encourage people to start opening themselves up to thirsting in a different way, where they're not thirsting authored by fear? Their thirst isn't authored by fear or performance, but it's authored out of genuine relational desire and longing for the presence of God.
I think it varies by the people involved. I mean, I don't have a stock answer to that kind of thing.
Yeah, no,
because I honestly think for some people, and this is sad to me, for some people, they had to completely just give up on faith and give up on God and kind of just find some freedom to live life without all that fear, because they just ejected God, that judging, tormenting God, and everybody around them panics. Oh, you got to do that. But honestly, I think sometimes disconnecting from it for a while allowed them to return to it with a different frame of mind. Now, I didn't do that personally. For me, I transitioned very slowly from beginning. For me, it started academically. I had a different atonement story that I talk about, and he loves me. That began to aim me in a different direction. That began to set my heart at rest in his presence. Watching God love me while I was making mistakes was huge. Because it was foreign to me. God couldn't love me while I'm doing something that displeases him.
Yes.
And when God was standing with me in my, let's say, less than stellar moments, or even just in the midst of sin.
Yeah.
And God's still there. I love you. And it messed with my theology, obviously, because the God I grew up with couldn't do that. So is this the real God?
Correct.
But in the midst of that, it's a 30-year journey. I'm still in this journey.
Yeah.
And I'm still helping people sort that out, which I enjoy doing, because I think it's the most important thing in the world. How God reshapes our view of him so that he's endearing, not scary. Yeah. And so that his holiness is an invitation. It's not the cause of judgment. And that's what we did with holiness. We made it so scary and so impossible to attain at a human level, which it is anyway.
Yeah.
That it left us in the horror of, I'm always a failure to God, and I'm always depressed, I'm always struggling. Seeing God love me at my most broken always is transformative to me. In the middle of my fears, in the middle of my doubts, the things I thought would exclude presence didn't. And when that becomes real, then you can relax. I'm able to now relax into that love, even in the midst of a mess, and say, God, do you see the mess I'm in? And how do you want to take me through it from here? And his faithfulness to be there has just continued to win my heart. And helping people see that, I think we get blinders on when I'm messing up. God's not here. And then I'm trying to find a God that isn't real, and they get frustrated. So I try to help people. What fingerprints do you see? Where's God breathing into your heart today? What is he showing you? And letting that begin to find some traction in spiritual life.
That has been, I think, one of the interesting, most challenging spaces for Father and I to work through has been, I love you. I am present with you. I am in the midst of it with you. And I still love you. Even in the midst of your darkest, most messed up, et cetera, moments, I am still there. And my love is greater than those things. And that, I had a very similar experience that kind of catalyzed all of this for me, was when I had that experience in that counseling retreat where I felt like I was at my worst and that it was all laid bare. I mean, all the dark things that I've been considering, all my mess, all my anger, all my depression, et cetera, and felt completely seen and completely loved. Yep. And that was so disruptive. I mean, that was that moment where I understood then when C.S. Lewis said the divine collision, is like, oh yeah, this is what he was talking about, because it does not align with what I knew of who God was. There was no way that he could see me in my biggest mess and still love me, still say, I see you and I approve of you as my son. I love you. I am here with you. That was so disruptive to my fear-based theology. I mean, I think it had to be that significant of a collision, because I don't know if it would have shaken me out of those real deep entanglements of God is fear. God is this perfectionistic performance holiness that you have to cower underneath. And that was what really started for me the fissures in the religious pretense that he was able to start breaking loose with his love.
Yeah, one of the things that Strahan Coleman says in the book Thirsting that kind of prompted some of this dialogue with us the last couple of months. Toward the end of the book, he says this: I've come to know that the aching, which is the maybe expressed in loneliness, that aching to love, the aching to be loved, is the very groan of the spirit I'm longing for. My participating in the conversation, God's longing for me from within me, his thirsting to be thirsted for. Now, when I feel that way, I lean in, trusting that the thirst is his presence, that my thirsting is my drinking, that living in the ache of our thirst, it's to allow our pain, shame, and vulnerability to be a holy invitation for belovedness and not to numb it in the hope of relief. This is what it is to be seen by God. And that's a powerful way to kind of bring to a landing some of what he was sharing in that book. And like I said, it's a mixed bag. People are reading it saying, this is not as fun a book to read as I thought it would be. And I just go, okay, there are some religious points in it. But when it gets to places like this, that when I'm ache to know him and I'm with him and I don't see much happening and that aching grows, to see that as the groan of the spirit, to be able to sit with him in our pain and our shame and not try to fix all that through confession and all that before we show up there. And then we don't have anything to talk about with him because we're invisible. This demanding, exacting deity made me as a child not to want to be seen by God. even though being seen for who we are is an important part of love, right? It is. It's no longer to be invisible, huge not have a voice, not be able to express. But the very religious tactics we were using made me want to be unseen. That'll be careful little eyes, what you see, for the Father above is looking down in love. Those things, man, we grew up on that stuff and just, okay, God, don't be looking now. I don't want to be seen. Yeah. And now at my worst moment, I want to be seen. I want God in that moment. My fear, my anxiety, my anger, my whatever doesn't make me a pariah to God. It is the holy invitation to belovedness, which I love how that flips the script on things we used to fear and try to hide from God to now things are shame and whatever. We can embrace God through those things.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of difference.
Oh, it's a huge difference. And that kind of aligns with the conversation that David and I were having. One of the questions that I asked him was, when did he first, or what was the process of him being able to call God Papa in like an endearing, loving, kind friendship way? Because for me, that was initially, I was very much like you just described of like, I don't want to be seen at all. So I'm going to just stay off your radar to the best of my ability. I'm not going to do anything, hopefully anything major or significant. Yeah. So I just stay off your radar. Then it's like, okay, well, this Jesus guy is kind of okay. I feel like he's a little more loving and caring and a little more approachable. And so then there was the whole theology of, well, Jesus is standing between you and the Father. And so it was like, okay, I really hope that Jesus is standing in between me and God right now, because I'm not at my best right now. And hopefully Jesus is also looking the other way. Hopefully Jesus is looking at the Father, not seeing what I'm up to, and that the Father is only seeing Jesus and not me, versus this whole space of I can be at rest and excited about being in communion with the Trinity of God, of the Godhead. And that, like, to be able to be at rest with that and to be able to enjoy that, because there, especially with the Father figure, there was so much fear that was tied up into that. It was like, okay, well, the Holy Spirit, we're not going to really talk about him. The Bible's got him covered. And Jesus, you know, Jesus is more loving. He liked kids. You know, he liked the vagabonds and the people that the outcasts that the church, you know, they weren't overly excited about. But man, you bet that Father, he's kind of bipolar and with a pretty significant anger streak. So you might want to just keep your distance there.
Yeah. And you wouldn't even call him bipolar, because that would be a problem.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That would be heresy.
And that would be unbelief. And God, of course, God's not saying anything to you because you have such an unbelieving heart. And there's all the ways that so diminishes us. Can you imagine the only way we felt safe to be with God was when he couldn't see us behind Jesus?
Yeah.
And I was schooled in that. You know, it's the little password clue with this red film that's over the answer to the word. And you put the word inside the red film. And then all of a sudden you can read the word that was there. And that's what we were taught. God can't see your sin. God can't see. God only sees the good you. And now I can't be seen by him at the point where I most need to be seen by him.
Yes.
Because he's unsafe when we're broken. That's what Adam and Eve assumed when they went running off to hide in the garden. And I think it's harder for religiously schooled people to wrap their hearts around a God of love inside your sin, inside your fear, inside your anxiety. Somehow I have to fix it. And then maybe when I've shown him enough sincerity, he will honor that with presence.
Yeah.
And if anything, these conversations that we're having right now do for people, I would hope it would poke a hole in that lie.
Yes.
That you can't be seen in your brokenness or in your feeling of shame, or your crying out in shame isn't a crying out of your thirst for the living God instead of, no, it's the thing keeping me from him. No, it's how do you open your heart to that?
Yeah.
How do you, like we talked about last week, how do you incubate the environment in which our recognition of his presence can take place?
Yeah.
I was talking to someone last week and he was sharing a book that he'd been reading that really touched his life. And as he was talking about the third part of that book, he just broke up. I mean, he could hardly talk. He was choking, his tears in his eyes. And then he kind of, like most men do, trying to push past that vulnerability moment, because that's what we were taught not to be. We were taught not to be vulnerable. Real men don't cry, all that stuff. And I backed him up. I said, what was it about the third part of the book that brought those tears to your eyes?
Yeah.
And his answer was, good question. Yeah, I know it's a good question. I don't know. Yeah. And then he kind of did something that was, again, not in his mind, but he thought it was the answer to what he was saying. It was deflecting a little bit. And so I brought him back to it. I said, now let's find out. Because I find for myself, when I tear up or choke up, even about something seemingly unrelated to God, it might be a movie or a book I'm reading or something, or a conversation, something causes me to choke. And I've all my life learned, bury that.
Yep.
Collect yourself. Don't let anybody see into that. And boy, for the last 10 years, I'm going right there. Wherever I find myself being choked up by something, there's the Holy Spirit laying his finger on something.
Yeah.
And if I don't pause to find out what it is, I'm going to miss it. Mm. And I've missed much of that in my life. And now I don't. So even when I see other people do, I was in New York last week, similar kind of moment with somebody, just something was choked. Hey, what was that? I'm like, and they kind of blow it off. And I go, no. Can we just stop a minute if you're open to it? Because I find that's where the Holy Spirit is at work, because suddenly something has made emotional reality to me that I may not even understand why I choked up in that moment. And it may even take a day or two to sort it out. And I kind of help people explore that too, because if people really want a relationship with Jesus is meaningful, and he's the one making the entreaties, it's not how we seek our way into it. It's how God is already interacting with us that we're missing, because the rigmarole of life and the demands, and it's just, and particularly for men, the whole patriarchy thing, I had a conversation with someone about, you know, men and being strong and the whole, you know, Eldridge view of manhood and rescuing a damsel in distress and all that stuff. And I said, you know, I think the most powerful expression of masculinity is tenderness.
Mm.
I went, what? I said, yeah. I grew up in all the bravado stuff. You know, men are strong and men are, even when you're faking it, you got to fake it. That's what part of malehood is. And vulnerability and tenderness to me is what makes us human and takes more strength to live inside your vulnerability than it does your bravado.
Oh, absolutely. For me, one of the beauties of that is starting out with that identity or that knowing, that deep knowing that I am totally and completely and radically and relentlessly loved by Christ. Because I was talking a little bit about, because when you even thinking about like the bravado, why do you need the strength? Why do you need the bravado? Now, granted, there have been times in my life where I've needed incredible amounts of strength and navigating things with people and working through that. And when God supplies it, when God has been the author of it, it has been beyond understanding. That's the only way for me to be able to describe it, because it's not this earthly perspective of like hyper-toxic aggression, but there's a lot of power and a lot of strength behind it. But then on the flip side, the tenderness, the openness, the vulnerability, the authenticity, and being able to live there and know that that is strength, that is a powerful expression of God's heart through the heart of a man. And even so in the conversation that my dad and I were having, we were talking about this core identity statement, and God's been really unraveling, I guess. He's been really unraveling how deep that has gone for me. And my dad threw back this really interesting question. He's like, I wonder what God's healing redemption would look like with that statement. And that launched into this really cool conversation about how, because of the things that God's led me into and the things that God has asked me to live into, as far as like my strengths and the amount of authority that I have and the people that I'm influencing, that whole conversation of me being an irresponsible son, initially it was saturated by shame. It was saturated by this fear. That was the whole authoring of it. But as over time, God's been, without me even knowing, has been removing the fear from that and teaching me how to be more, because my natural personality is not disciplined, is not very organized, is not very disciplined. It is not very responsible. And yet God knew who he needed me to be, who he wanted me to be in the world. And part of my ability to be able to live that out wholeheartedly is to have a level of responsibility and discipline. And yet God's been moving, without me even knowing, moving me away from a fear and shame-based expression of that to a wholehearted in his identity expression of that. And I didn't even know it was happening. He's probably been, I don't even know how many years God's been working on that. Mm-hmm. And it's only been on my radar, being able to put language around that and really processing that conversation with him for the last 6 weeks. That to me is just like, wow, God, when we think about him cultivating, when we think about him creating that thirsting, that longing, authoring that longing, that desire for him, that's how passionate he cares about it. He was laying foundations for me to be able to experience his love long before I even knew that was a potentially existent reality. And yet he was doing it. He was prepping the soil for me to be able to experience his love and for it to be able to grow deep roots.
That's why when we talk about people cultivating that environment in their hearts to recognize yeah. God, it's real important is I think it helps me to realize God has been at work in me in ways I haven't seen that prepares me for the moments I'm now seeing.
Yes.
So yeah. Which is what Strahan was saying about this hunger rising in our hearts. It may be unmet right now, yeah. but the hunger is part of the relationship. It is, rather than despising it and thinking it proves me a failure because I have a desire I'm not experiencing yet.
Yeah.
To experience the thirst for presence as part of the process by which presence becomes real. And I think pausing to ask good questions. I know most of my journey with Jesus comes not by waiting for words from God that go, oh, wow, that puts a finger on something. I love it when that happens.
Yep.
I think more importantly, it's been the questions I ask that probe deeply. The questions like, God, why aren't you doing this? And all that, those are fruitless. But the questions go, why did I choke up back there? What yeah. what's in my heart? Or this tension I feel in my gut, man, I don't feel like I'm anxious about anything, but I obviously am.
Yeah.
And asking questions, which is important in just human relationships, asking yeah. questions and curiosity and exploring is so important. And somehow the religious, we got to have all the answers in the Bible, quote a scripture. It's taken us away from the honesty of asking the questions that then I hear God's observation beyond that question and go, oh my goodness, that there's the insight right there. But I really wonder if I don't come to the question,
yeah,
if I'm not free to explore it, how much of that I've missed in my lifetime? And I think it's quite a bit, honestly.
Yeah.
Because I'm more interested in getting an answer and getting something fixed and moving on. Used to be, now it's, yeah. now I'm going to hang here a moment. Because I don't know what's going on, and yeah. I don't want to just shove it down and medicate it with, you know, TV or dinner or something. Yeah. I really want to hang in this moment of disorientation until, which I, if we're oriented toward flesh and we have disorientation as we move towards spirit, then that would make sense. It would make sense why I'm feeling disoriented. Yeah. I know the comfortable way to solve it is back there with my old habits, patterns, even religious sensibilities. I know how to yep. medicate it.
Yep.
But if I just let it hang for days at a time and see yeah. part of that hanging as the hunger that creates the environment where I'll recognize what God, like you just said, God has been doing this for years. I've just been unaware of it. Doesn't mean it hasn't been happening. Most yeah. of my growth discoveries in the last 10 years come at the end of a process with him. Yeah. Where you go, oh, that's what that was about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess this is why I keep circling back to how important it is to know and have a healthy snapshot of his love for us, because if you feel like you're serving a vengeful and vindictive God, then waiting in that discomfort, holding space for that, being present in that, that is utterly terrifying. To do that, that it's like, why would you do that? There, everything in me is telling me run from this. But if I know that as a part of a loving and passionate father who has committed himself to seeing the brokenhearted binded up, to see the captive set free, if that's who he is, then this disorientation, this discomfort, this tension inside, this emotional disruption, whatever this ache longing is that's going on inside of me that I can't put language around yet, that is a byproduct of a passionate, loving God who is in the continued work of working out his salvation in your life to this day. And that's, so then it's like, okay, I can hold comfort. I can hold that. I can hold that discomfort. I can hold the not knowing. I can hold the, Lord, why, you know, even the, Lord, why aren't you healing this person in this time? Or why are we not seeing healing in the speed or the pace or the format that we were hoping for? Or why is this financial situation not getting resolved in the way that it is? Even in those, I can hold that and say, Lord, I'm not seeing what you're doing, but I do know that you love me. I do know that your heart is the best for me and that the invitation that you place in front of me is genuine, wholehearted life. And so because I trust that, because I've known that and I've seen it to be faithful in my life, I can hold these really uncomfortable spaces that feel like I should be running, feel like I should be learning how to cope, feel like I should be pressing down. I can continue to hold those and give them time, space, energy, and focus because I know they're being authored by love.
And feeling ashamed because I should be further along than I am by now. I hear that all the time from people.
Yes.
I've noticed as you were talking, all these things that we've been talking about today, seeing God in a different way, seeing the loving, kind, compassionate God to whom we want to be seen by, not the one we need to hide from, to be able to sit in the uncomfortable. Those things have come true in my life the more I've learned to rest inside his love.
Yeah.
Because that's where we're open to the places where God works.
Yeah.
If it's coming from panic and fear and trying to make something right and get it done on my own, all that panic stuff inside is the opposite of what we're talking about. And so those of you who are really learning, I want to rest in that love. That's what I'd be talking to Jesus about. Why am I not at rest in your love? And that's where I'd be seeking out help from somebody. If I know somebody who is at rest in that love, take your vulnerability there. Just, I love how at rest you are. I'm not, and here's why I'm not. Here's what I'm struggling with. If you struggle with this, how have you been helped in that? And not by people who want to fix you, except people who want to help you learn the value of resting in love, because all the good things we're talking about come at that point.
Yeah, because it's literally a neurological oxymoron to say, I'm going to be at rest with somebody that I fear.
Right.
If you don't feel like that person is safe, if they're at the core of who you are, you don't feel like that person is safe or trustworthy. And to say, I'm going to be present with him. I'm going to spend time with him. I'm going to position myself in a place of vulnerability with him. That is a neurological oxymoron. Your subconscious nervous system will not let you do that because it's pre-programmed by him not to let you do that.
Exactly.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.